Hi, welcome back to The Monologue. Here at The Monologue, we take a thematic deep dive into the works of Mike Flanagan, exploring recurring motifs, creative processes, and collaborations in the Flaniverse. And of course, most importantly, The Monologue. My name is Cecilia. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Kelsey and Riley, and a super duper, very special guest, the co-host, producer, editor, creator of the KingCast, Eric Thespey.
Hello. Woo! This is a pretty big get. I know that you had to go through many layers of people to get me on the show, and I appreciate that. Yeah.
We had to talk to our agents, your agents, everybody's agents. But yeah. You're here.
Happy to be here.
Thank you, Eric. Glad to have you. Glad to see you and talk to you again, you know, on camera.
Well, I'm sorry you have to see my face. That's the one downside. Oh. I feel a little run down today. We came back from a whirlwind trip to California, and I've essentially, this is my resting period right now. I came back, I had to do like a big interview like the morning after, and so now I'm like, okay, I can just chill for the weekend. So
please, we are very chill here. I have just worked 14 hours yesterday, today, tomorrow, and the next day, so I might fall asleep on camera. You're just here to kind of keep us awake, I think.
What an overachiever. Damn, look at this. Making everybody else look bad. Damn.
Oh my god. When you work with disabled people, they don't stop. They got stuff going on 100% of the time.
Always, yeah.
Truly. It's like I feel like I'm their PA on set a lot of the time, because it's always like, I'm just carrying boxes, I'm driving everyone around, I'm getting everybody lunch, I'm keeping everybody other than myself sane.
You're like a teaching assistant, but for daily life.
It's nuts.
You need to get a less stressful job. You know, maybe you can be a busker.
You
can learn the drums.
Busker's forever, man. I have been wanting to learn the drums, and now I honestly want someone else to do it so I can just kind of stand in the middle of the sidewalk and dance.
Yeah, so if you couldn't tell from that little transition segue, we are talking about Mike Flanagan's newest feature film, which is now in theaters everywhere, The Life of Chuck.
And if you've all seen it, which you have, we're joined by two very special stars of the movie. Yep. Which we can finally talk about, because we've all been keeping that secret for a little while. But very exciting. If you've seen the movie, you more than likely, if you're a fan of us or the KingCast, or you more than likely have spotted Kels, Eric, Scott in the movie, in the end credits. It's very, very cool.
Right. Well, you've spotted the back of our heads and
the
Wampler's
face.
Yeah,
you've spotted Wampler's mohawk and Eric's radio voice, which I apparently missed. I'm going to have to go see the movie again.
Yeah, I got there some of us late. Have seen all of our appearances in the movie, and some of us haven't. Riley.
You'll just get to go see it again. It's fine.
You just have to go see it again.
Honestly, I might tonight. It was wonderful.
Yeah,
like I walked out of that theater a changed man. It was nice.
You know, one thing that's great about Mike is when he puts his whole heart into what he's doing, it's always going to be special. Even if the stuff doesn't hit me, like, say, Bly Manor doesn't hit me in the same way that Haunting of Hill House does, you know, but you can't watch that series and not just be deeply affected by it, because there is no pretense with Mike, right? And I think that's why he's kind of maybe the only human on earth that could have made this movie. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's not all that radically different from the Stephen King novella that he adapted. You know, a lot of the previous King adaptations, he had to do, you know, pretty radical adaptations. You know, he had to, Dr. Sleep bears, I don't know, maybe 30% resemblance to the book, you know, but it feels right, you know, and it feels like it is what it should be. In Gerald's Game, he had to invent the whole, envisioning herself talking to herself kind of stuff in order to kind of get past that thing that works in the novel where you can have one character that's tied to a bed, you know, and in her monologue, she couldn't be sitting there on the bed going, gee, I wonder what I could do next, you know, like that wouldn't work. So this one is fairly like one-to-one what the story is. There's little tweaks here or there, but it's pretty much just the novella. And but it takes somebody like Mike to, and sorry, you can tell I run a Stephen King show because I'm like just grabbing the ball and running. But it takes somebody like Mike who can kind of match, you know, King's big old beating heart himself, right? You know, and adapt that correctly. So I think the movie's pretty special. Like, I couldn't tell you if 10 people are going to see it or if, like, you know, 10 million people are going to see it. I don't know if it'll win 1,000 Oscars or not get nominated. I have no idea, but it's something that I know I like.
I loved it. And I think that's, you're absolutely right. There is some kind of magic to it. And it just, I think, is coming from pure earnestness and wanting to, it's an incredibly nihilistic film, but in the most upbeat kind of way. And I think you need to have someone that is very willing to expose themselves entirely. Sorry for the phrasing, Mike, if you ever hear that. but yeah, I think he was perfect for it. And I do think, I find it very interesting because, like you said, there are adaptations that he has made and has had to take great liberties with, like Hill House. You can't remake Hill House. You have to do something else. Did it perfectly. Dr. Sleep, same thing. And this one, when I heard the announcement that Mike was directing this, it became another like, oh, but it's so unadaptable. And I, reading it, was like, no, this one seems like one of the most straightforward ones. You just have to figure out that pacing with the backwards narrative. But it was done so beautifully and it connected everything so perfectly.
Yeah, and I think the only way this movie could have really been made is by someone like Mike Flanagan, where you can see the heart and soul. Like, I don't think this could have been made as, like, a corporate cash grab. It really has to be made by somebody who you can tell loves the source material and also has something to say about life. And also is a really beautiful, like, if you look at Mike Flanagan's career, we had talked about this on the Oculus episode about how a lot of Mike's earlier films have these really, like, dark endings. And this is such a beautiful arc for him in his career so far to have this sort of an ending and to pick this sort of a project.
And I feel like it's more relevant now even than like when King wrote the story or like when it was filmed. Like the story came, did it come out in 2020 or was it just before?
That's a good question. It was 2020 or 2021, I think, right?
So I think that, like,
Mike says he read it in lockdown, right?
Oh, so then it must have come out before. But I feel like a lot of people, because that was around the time that it came out, and so you're reading the beginning when everything is in chaos and like, oh, COVID, this reminds me of COVID. Mm-hmm. But now it's kind of, it connects in a whole new way. Mm-hmm. And like, we need that hope that, like, yes, like in 2023, like, yeah, hope about the future is nice, but now it's like, oh no, like we need this movie right now.
Yeah. Well, and especially as someone in the trans community, it's a terrible, terrible time right now and does not appear to be getting any better. So I do think it is very nice to just have this movie that is the entire message of is, hey, you are wonderful. You contain multitudes. We are, it's very Taoist, honestly, in its philosophy of just, we are all one. We came from the same place. We're going back to the same place. So get your shit together and evaluate yourself and live better, which I think is also, you know, if you've read Leaves of Grass, Song of Myself is the opening of that, I believe. Very much true to what Walt Whitman was talking about then as well. So it's stayed relevant since 1890 something, and we still need it now. We're just grasping on for hope.
Yeah, very, very beautifully said. Not to derail our talk of Chuck, but we were going to start with talk of Eric.
My favorite.
The life of Eric.
I gave you a little bit of an introduction, but is there anything else you want to say about who you are, what you do, and then we'll go into your Flana history backstory, you know?
Sure. I mean, I'm just essentially been a professional nerd for my entire life. In high school, I took a newspaper class because I liked writing and I liked entertainment stuff, and I was kind of angling to maybe get in, like, to do movie reviews or that kind of thing. And well, funnily enough, even before the newspaper class, you couldn't just jump into newspaper. You had to go through like journalism 101 first. You had to take, you know, a prerequisite class. And so I'm taking journalism 101 in my freshman year of high school. I'm 14 years old, and I get it in my head to walk across over to the newspaper office, which shared a door with the journalism class. And I was just like, hey, I like George Carlin. George Carlin's coming to town. I'm going to go see him. My dad got us tickets to go see George Carlin perform at the Paramount Theater. And like, can I write a review of this for you guys? And they're just like, okay, nerd, whatever, you know, if you want to. And so then I went there, and of course I didn't just like want to review the show. I needed to get a quote from George Carlin. So I stayed afterwards, waited for him to come out, which he didn't, but his manager did. And his manager like, was like, hey, like, essentially, what the fuck are you still doing here? And I was like, hey, you know, I'm writing for my high school newspaper. I want to interview George Carlin. And he goes, ah, George is like, he's got two shows today. He's busy. But here's my card. Give me a call. Maybe we can set something up. And I said, yeah, don't worry about it. It's not a big, you know, it's not like a stressful thing. It's just a high school newspaper. And he goes, that's why I think he might do it. And you know, within a couple of weeks, I was on the phone with George Carlin, and I interviewed him over the phone. And that audio, as long as it's in my power to not let anybody in the world hear it, I will. It'll stay locked up because I went back and listened to it. I don't know, about 5 or 6 years ago, and I'm like, oh, it can't be that bad. And it's literally like ring, 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 ring. Hello, this is George Carlin. How are you? And then like 8 seconds of silence, and I go, hi. So that's kind of the vibe of that thing. But ever since then, like, you know, I've been working in and around movies, interviewing folks. I interviewed a bunch of people from my high school newspaper, from the guy that was in the suit playing Darth Vader, David Prowse, to Mike Judge and all the local Austin folks. And then that got me, you know, caught the attention of the guy running Ain't It Cool News back in the day. And while I was still in high school, I was writing for one of the biggest movie news websites, and stuck with that for over 20 something years. Then turned out the guy that hired me was a sex pest. And so I had to leave that and did some freelancing stuff. And that led to me going, well, there's only a couple of things I can really talk about, you know, with any sort of like knowledge or enthusiasm. And that's Stephen King and Steven Spielberg. And now I have a podcast dedicated to each. So, that is the, believe it or not, that's a truncated version of my backstory. So I can give you a whole another 30-minute long one if you want, but maybe when we
see you next, we'll sit down for a longer discussion.
Part two.
Yeah, maybe not on film. Yeah. But no, that's incredible. Life is so random, and I am so glad that obviously it has worked out and you are thriving and living your best life, it seems like.
Yeah, and I somehow convinced this one to marry me in the fall. So
listen, I talked you up a lot before you guys got together out of for no reason. I was like, oh, Eric's cute. You should date him.
We did. Yeah.
I mean, listen, we were all on the same page. We were rooting for it.
Well, you were. Prague was like, be careful, he might be gay.
Oh, I mean, fair.
You know what? That's what we have Prague for, though. He's the, you know what? You guys are, you might want to think about things before you do them.
Yeah. At least have a safety net.
Yeah.
But
we need a voice of reason.
But if that George Carlin interview ever happens to leak on the internet, it wasn't me.
Oh, okay. You don't know who it was.
You don't know where the tape is. It's going to be buried.
I have an idea.
Oh, great.
I'm not going to leak it.
Okay, good.
Yet.
Yeah. Not until we need the publicity.
Then yes, you can alert exactly.
The hopefully they'll write a better headline than they did about when you left Ain't It Cool.
Yeah, you can tell that story about your mom's first Google on me. Yeah.
So there was an article written about Eric leaving Ain't It Cool for, how did you word it, sex pest reason, but he was not the sex pest. No. It was
Harry, the guy who ran it, right?
Yeah. Oh, yikes.
So the headline is something like, Eric Vespi leaves Ain't It Cool news amid sexual
assault allegations or something. And that was the first thing her mom read about me.
My mom Googled him, and that was one of the first things that came up at the time under news, and she was like, and I was like, just read the article, just read it. And then the article clarifies that it was not him, he left because someone else
committed sexual assault.
It was like me and three other writers left at the same time.
But that headline was like a little bit of character assassination there, because if people have short attention spans, and if they don't actually open the article, it's not clear.
I'm going to find this article, print it, and frame it for your wedding present.
Oh my God, that's perfect. Yeah, we should maybe scrub that off of the internet. They really phrased that against you.
Yeah,
sorry,
that's not wonderful. I'll say that. No. But I don't know. Nobody else has mentioned it other than my mom.
So. Yeah, no, I've never come across it, but thankfully I learned who you were through Flanagan stuff. Because I think it was an episode where either Mike or Kate or both of them were on the KingCast. Mm-hmm. And then just led me to that podcast, this friendship with Kells, this new friendship with Eric, and it's been very cool. But speaking of, we do have to get a Flanagan origin story. So do you remember the when and where and why and hows of coming across any of the Flaniverse?
I can tell you the first time that I heard his name was a mutual friend of ours ran into me at South by Southwest. Her name is Molly Elfman, and I think she worked on Oculus.
She did Next Exit
movie, yeah, with Katie Parker,
with Kate and Rahul. Yeah, that was a great film.
Yeah. And so, like, I've known her just through, you know, film nerd circles, you know, going way back into the early Ain't It Cool days. And so, you know, it wasn't a surprise to see her on the street in Austin, you know, here for South by Southwest. But I guess she was either helping promote the movie or she helped produce Oculus. I don't remember. But she's like, you have to see this movie. I have this movie here called Oculus, a great rising, you know, genre filmmaker. You got to see it. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to make a point to see it. And like I so often do, I did not keep my word on that and got busy and didn't get to see it there. But I did see it when it came out. And I don't know if that was my first Flanagan movie, though.
It would have been, because you didn't see...
I saw Ouija.
But have you seen Absentia?
No, I still have not seen Absentia.
I need to show him Absentia.
Wow. Oh, you most definitely do. Yeah. Speaking of Parker, Katie Parker is a fucking force in that.
Right.
And I think you must be right, because I think Danny Elfman did the music for Oculus, right?
Oh, you could be.
So
yeah,
it would have made sense, because
Molly's Danny Elfman's daughter. So
yeah.
That would have been a connection there. Yeah.
Yeah, in my head, I was like, no, that definitely, because the Newton Brothers weren't until after that one.
But yeah, I'm trying to remember, like, maybe you guys would know the order of events, but Ouija 2 was the first time where I was just like, huh, whoever did that did such a better job than the first movie. Right. And I remember seeing it going like, oh, this is so much. I went in like bare bottom expectations. Like, why were we even seeing this? Because I didn't like that first movie very much at all. And I'm like, I'm not like, why do I have to watch this? And I'm watching and going, oh, this is actually pretty good. And so that was probably the first time I actually clocked Mike there. Mm-hmm. And then right before we did the KingCast, matter of fact, first times we took meetings about it, me and Scott, I was spending the summer in LA, and we took like phone meetings with Fangoria, who would eventually become our network. And they weren't like, they didn't quite understand what the hell we were wanting to do. This is like 2019, I guess. That's when Dr. Sleep came out, right? It's 2019.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because when we were in LA, I got a notice for a test screening opportunity to see Dr. Sleep, and I was like, "Ooh, I'm gonna go." And you know, that's kind of a crapshoot, because if they know you're at all in the business, then they will kick you out of that line or whatever. They want the normies to give their opinion, and so I went to go see that they didn't spot me. I saw Mike come in. I think I recognized him at that point. I'm like, oh, that's funny. He sat a couple rows in front of me. We didn't know each other then. And I got to see Dr. Sleep with some preliminary effects for all like the dream stuff whenever, or the astral projection stuff whenever Rose is like hunting down Abra and all that. A lot of that was still green screen. You could see wires and stuff. So it was pretty neat. It's pretty neat. So like, I mean, I'd kind of followed him like curiously because Gerald's Game was really good. You know, I really liked Hush when it came out. You know, I liked Haunting of Hill House when it came out. And so he was on my radar, but like I didn't, before I started the KingCast, I'd never really talked to him. And he started, I think, following both me and Scott on Twitter back then, like right early in the early days of starting. And I think he was in the first dozen or a couple dozen guests of the show.
Yeah, because so. I remember when we were in New Zealand a couple years ago, just for fun, we were looking back at like the order of the Patreon subscribers, mm-hmm. and like Mike was like within the first 10, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
You know what? That doesn't surprise me at all because one, Mike is always like from the time that I started engaging with his media, has always been very active in talking to, you know, fans of his work, other people in the community. And I've had friends who are like YouTubers or podcasters, and they'll message me and be like, some guy named Mike Flanagan followed me or on Patreon. Is this actually him? I'm like, I'm pretty sure it probably is. He like paid for most of my top surgery. That dude is crazy generous and just wants to talk to people and do good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, he's a, you know, the word ally can get thrown around a lot, but like, you know, he is somebody who, when he believes in you and believes in something you either stand for, you're fighting for, you're wanting, like he'll show up, yeah, and you know, sometimes monetarily, sometimes just in his presence. I mean, the banger in Bangor that we did, you know, that probably, yeah, wouldn't have really happened if he and Kate weren't so gracious about not only agreeing to do it, but like they're just like, we'll go on every one of the tours, anything you need from us. And it's just, and I, like, I remember I reached out to them and I'm just like, listen, you know, the show's, it's doing well, but it's like doing well enough to keep Scott and I from having to get day jobs. Right. That, you know, we're not like raking in the dough here. So we're, you know, it's like, obviously if you are willing to come out to Maine with us, like we can, you know, we'll scramble together miles or the money for the plane tickets. But I'm just like, we can't afford to fly you guys like business or anything like that. But, you know, we'll do whatever we can to make it work. And he was like, no, you don't worry about it. We want to come out. So they paid their own way to be guests at our convention thing because they knew that it was a big financial risk for us to, you know, to lock in the venue, to organize, you know, everything. We had no idea if anybody was going to show up. And thankfully, you know, it was a really well attended event.
Oh, so, we showed up. We took that town over for the weekend. Yeah.
And that's the best that Maine's ever been. Can I say that? I think so. I think that week that we were there was probably the best that Maine's ever been.
The second best time would be when we went to spread Scott's ashes. That was probably because now Scott and Pennywise are forever linked in the Pennywise drain.
That's true. We put a little of a pop-up in the pipe. Yeah.
And
where he belongs.
Are we gonna get arrested if I say about the frog?
No, I don't think so.
Excuse me.
What you do to the frog?
Yeah, that's a great intro to a story that does not live up to what you think it's going to be here.
So the Stephen King house in Maine, which it sounds creepy saying that, but he doesn't actually live there anymore.
It's now like the headquarters of the Stephen and Tabitha King Foundation.
It's basically like a museum kind of at this point. So it's not like we were actually like going to his residential address or anything. There is a frog statue in the corner of the yard, and we sprinkled some of Scott's ashes on the frog, so now he is one with the Stephen King frog.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, I think Uncle Steve would be okay with that.
Yeah, probably not, but we're, you know,
well, he doesn't have to know. He doesn't listen to this one, as far as I know.
How's it gonna happen?
Oh, Stephen King listens to our podcast. All right, hi Steve.
before we completely move, I kind of messed that up. Before we completely move away from the stories of why Mike Flanagan is such a good human, can I throw out another story?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, sure. Please.
When the Life of Chuck came out, we were very kindly invited to the premiere in LA, and very kindly invited to the after party, which obviously is Mike's big moment, like his for his movie. And we went over to talk to him, and his like first reaction was like to Eric, like, I know you really want to be introduced to Mark Hamill. I know you really want to meet Mark Hamill. So here, I'm going to go introduce you to Mark Hamill so that you can talk to him. So it's like his shining moment. And he was like making other people's like wishes come true.
Yeah. I hugged him. He said, we did it. And I'm just like, I just like read a couple of things. It's been like 15 minutes on this movie. You spent like 3 years. But I'm just like, thank you. And I'm just like, I congratulated him. And he just pulls back and he looks at me and goes, do you want to meet Mark Hamill? And I'm just like, yes, I do. I would very much like to meet Mark Hamill. And then I kind of embarrassed myself with Mark. So
no, it was very loud.
I don't think he could hear me very well. Nah. Cause I think what he interpreted me as saying, I know it sounds like I'm this like giant, like, oh my God, he's a voice actor. He's in all this stuff. I've done it like cameos in a couple of things. But one of the other things I got to do was I got to voice one of the Resistance bombers in The Last Jedi. Ooh. And so that was one. I don't get a physical cameo in that one, but Rian Johnson let me come in and do like a little recording. So at the beginning, there's like a guy that's there, but he's got like a mask around his face so he can breathe in the no atmosphere. So that way, you know, anybody could have voiced him. And so, Rian said, you do this one. And it's like, you know, I have visual on the target, you know, it's like all this kind of jargon. And then he blows up and dies, right? Like the TIE fighter gets shot, he goes into the bomb bay, you know, all the bombs.
R.I.P.
Did you get to scream?
I screamed. Yeah. So I have a Star Wars scream, and he, like, Rian had me do it like 3 or 4 times, and it just sounded like, you know, wasn't good. And he's like, really push yourself on the next one. And I did. And my voice cracked and like went up an octave. And it's not really of the level of a Wilhelm scream, but it has a little bit of that flavors. And when I did that, Rian like did like a happy dance. I'm like, so I know at least that part's going to make it into the movie. So I'm like, aha, when I meet Mark Hamill, this is my in, as I can say, you and I have something in common. We both died in The Last Jedi. And
I'm wondering what he thought you said.
And I'm not 100% sure he thought. I think that my guess is he interpreted that is into me. I died inside as a Star Wars fan. Which I do not. I love The Last Jedi. I think it's
What? That is. It's the most polarizing of the new films, because I think it's brilliant.
I also like Last Jedi.
Yeah. It's fun. Yeah.
Took a big swing.
And people are going to come around on it. It's just going to be, you know, as somebody who lived through the, you know, from 1999 to 2005, you know, that whole, everybody in that generation was like, fuck the prequels. The prequels suck. They've ruined Star Wars. You know, blah, 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 blah. Myself included. I was part of the problem. I fully admit.
We were all there. We were all on the same side, I'm sure.
Now if you open up YouTube, TikTok, guess whose time it is? It's the prequel kids' time. And all these prequel kids are hating on the sequel trilogy. And guess what? In 10, 15 years, they're going to be where I am right now. Right? And they're going to have all these kids where that's their Star Wars. Rey, Finn, and Poe are their Star Wars characters, right? Well, just as Anakin, Padme, and Obi-Wan were for that generation, and what, you know, Luke, Leia, and Han were for me. So when I said that to Mark Hamill, he kind of looked at me, and, you know, he was doing this thing with his ear. He was like, hey, what? I can't hear. And I'm like, oh, we both died in The Last Jedi. And he goes, yeah. And then he starts going off on, he's just like, Luke dies from using too much force. He's like, Obi-Wan should have said to Luke, hey, use the force, Luke, but only a little bit.
And, but not, you know, too
and
much.
Then he goes off on this anti, you know, Last Jedi thing. And I'm just like, cool, that's not what I intended.
Me under the bus. I did. Because when I worked at Guest Relations, I worked Star Wars weekends, and he used to come to Star Wars weekends pretty regularly. Mm-hmm. And the year when I was working in Guest Relations, so at Disney, when you are at work, you'll go to this machine and it'll print out a task for you. And so on the day, one of the days when he was there in the parade, the task was like, you've been assigned as position extra security for Mark Hamill. And so was like telling, oh, like my fiance was like your security.
Yeah, Kelsey was your bodyguard.
But it's like the way that he worded it, he probably was like, you weren't the plaid that was assigned to me. And it's like, because he would have had no idea that I was assigned to him. I was just like, on the parade route, and
you are ready to jump in front of the bullet for him.
They were like, just make sure that no guests like are like run at the at the parade. And so I was just kind of hanging back and like, all right, everyone seems to be chill, like, so that's all I did. But he made it seem like a bigger deal, so that was Mark Hamill.
With your secret security,
he was very confused. I'm gonna make, you know, for sure my goal was to make Mike regret introducing us to Mark Hamill.
You know what?
I have no idea if I succeeded, but it certainly felt like I did.
I think I love that too, because even Mike has like embarrassing stories about meeting famous people. Mm-hmm. So it's just nice to know that, yeah, we are all just a bunch of idiots running around this planet, no matter if you were Luke Skywalker or not.
Well,
and Mark Hamill, Last Jedi rules. Get over yourself. Next.
Yeah, get over yourself. I know he
would now be a good time to transition to the little prank that you guys kind of pulled on Karen Gillan.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of huge movie stars, by the way, Karen Gillan, what a career that woman is having. Sounds like, I don't know what this prank is. We were told earlier that we were going to get an exclusive behind-the-scenes story.
I mean, it's not so much exclusive, I guess, because it's been on the
podcast. Tell them it's exclusive.
Well, we're getting it straight.
It's exclusive
from the
to us.
Yeah, exclusive.
This version of the story is exclusive to the monologue.
Oh, it's never been told before. Super secretive, breaking an NDA.
So the origins of our two cameos that we have, that Scott and I had in The Life of Chuck. It started with a vocal cameo, which, you know, Mike reached out. This is well before the full cast was released. Anyway, he reached out and was like, hey, so one, he sent us the script. No, he sent us the script for this. Sometimes he sends us the scripts early and we can read stuff. But this one he didn't do that.
It was significantly early, though, because so we went to set. It was October of 2023, because I had moved to Austin June of 2023, and he asked you guys about this before I'd moved to Austin, so it was before summer of 2023.
It was probably early 2023 is my guess, and I mean, I could go look up the files now and tell you, like, they'll have the timestamp on it, but the way it was, he's like, listen, you know, I listen to your show, and I have two, you know, I have this, you know, this part in the script where a character is listening to two NPR hosts on the radio talking. And I was like, I was thought maybe you and Scott would want to do that. And in my head, I'm like, okay, cool. It's like, you know, like, yeah, I can read a couple of lines of stuff and whatever. And he's like, yeah, just record it on your own and then send it to me. Record it like you record your podcasts. That audio will be totally fine. And I was like, cool. And then he's like, all right, here's the script. And, you know, your stuff starts on page 7 or whatever it was. And I looked at it and the motherfucker sent like a page and a half of dialogue. and I was just like, well, okay. And I'm like, and I were like, you know, we're not actors, right? So, and he's just like, yeah, just read it. You know, it's a radio show host. It's pretty much what you do. Just be yourselves. So Scott and I kind of read over the thing, you know, it's pretty easy, you know, we're not on camera, so we could just literally just read the text. And so we recorded three different goes at it. And it was all part of one file. The first one was like the somber one where we're like letting the weight of the world falling apart get to us kind of thing. The second part, you know, then we finished that out. And then we said, okay, now here, this one, we want to try one. Because nobody gave us any direction. So it was like, we're going to just give you a couple options. And we're going to try one where it's us trying to be professional and maybe, you know, feeling the weight of everything happening, but like doing it more of a straight news read, right? And we did that one. And then between that one and the third one, Wampler says, and now in honor of the late Dino De Laurentiis, We're going to do the next take with the most outrageous Italian accents that we could possibly do. And we rolled with it. And, you know, so we read the whole thing. It was like, Mamma mia, the Californians are falling into the ocean, you know, and like doing that kind of stuff for the entire thing. And we sent it that to Mike. And then we sent like, this is probably my favorite part. And when you go see the movie, you hear it's mostly me, a little bit Scott at the beginning where we're talking about the specifics, you know, the food scarcity is happening, you know, water is now the most, you know, valued resource with California gone and all the reservoirs and Nevada being the most populous state in the union and all that stuff. And then we recorded like 5 minutes of just Wampler and I riffing where we kind of went back to the text of the novella and was like reading all the stuff mm-hmm. that had been going on that, you know, maybe wasn't in the script or in this part, but like would be part of this world. And so it's just stuff because he asked us to do like a little bit of business to have like kind of muted in the background if they needed it. And so we recorded that. And that's what I'd say the bulk of the stuff is. But so we sent that off and thought nothing of it. Then we went to go visit the set. And he gave us physical cameos, theoretically as an excuse not to get us cleared by all the actors that were there. Because if we were technically hired for the movie as extras, then we wouldn't need to get approval to be on the set mm-hmm. from Tom Hiddleston's representatives and all
smart.
That
stuff.
And so, like, you know, they paid us like $70 or something, and we went
for like 15 minutes of work.
Pretty much.
We did like two takes, and then that was it.
Yeah, so we went out there, and Mike, the first thing he says was, said to us was like, that stuff was great. You know, we just assumed that it was okay because we didn't hear anything. But he's like, it was great. We're going with the somber one, the somber read. He said, but we're getting all this audio so we can play it back to the actors on the set. And he's like, we haven't done this yet, but I swear to you, when Karen Gillan is going to be the one listening to this, goes to listen to it, it's going to be the Italian accent version that you guys send. And get a reaction like, oh, you have to record that. Let us know. And then I didn't hear anything. And, you know, a year and some change goes by, you know, Scott dies in the meantime, like all this, you know, the world upends, everything goes crazy. And I had no idea if Mike ever remembered that. And, you know, cut to a couple of weeks ago, I had Karen Gillan on the KingCast. And I was just like, listen, you know, I don't mean to shock you, but you're talking with one of your co-stars in the movie right now kind of thing. And I was like, I have something to ask you. Was there something different about the reading on set? And she goes, oh my God, was it like in Spanish or something? And I said, close, but I'm so glad that you brought this. And yes. And she said that Mike, like she'd never seen him laugh harder. Like that it's a somber, serious moment where, you know, she and Rahul Kohli are there and they're like being all like down. They're part of this team in the movie called The Suicide Squad, where they're like the nurses that are, you know, essentially at their posts as the world's ending. So there's lots of suicides that are coming her way. So her character's not in a great spot at the beginning of the movie. And so she's somberly listening to this NPR report in the movie. It's us talking about, you know, California falling into the ocean, the mass migration into Nevada, there's no water, you know, blah, 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 all this stuff. And she's like kind of got a scrunchy face. And so now imagine her listening to that, but it's like, Mamma mia, things are going so bad, you know,
like Mario and Luigi are the radio hosts.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, still a better job than Chris Pratt did with Mario. I will say that, but,
well, that's not a high bar, but I'm sure you went way, way over.
So yeah, I was really happy to hear that confirmed. And then we ran in that episode where we were talking to Karen about it. I did plug in the 2-ish minutes of me and Scott doing the crazy Italian version of the thing. And we're not, you know, well, he can't be canceled, but I'm not canceled yet. So,
Scott
kind of canceled himself.
Scott is uncancelable now.
He's no longer here.
Or I guess God canceled him. I'm not really sure how that
went. Yeah, you can, I mean, you know, you can definitely, it definitely feels like it sometimes.
Yeah. Oh. What an asshole. I can't believe you made this whole movie all about him.
I know. And, yeah, and then Mike ended up dedicating it to him. That was like the nicest part of the Mark Hamill thing, by the way, because when he introduced us, he was like, you know, Eric runs the Stephen King podcast, and Mark was like, oh, the one you know, that your friend or whatever, you know, the movie's dedicated to. I said, yep, that's exactly it. So you know, and that was really nice. And talk another good guy Mike story is that we were making plans, Scott and I, to see him the day that Scott died.
And me.
You know, she was like, I don't know if I'm interested in hanging out with Mike. But we were kind of, you know, texting about it, and it was kind of in an unsure period. I remember where he's like, I have this and this, but maybe we can grab dinner after. And then Scott died that afternoon, and it was a rough day. You know, I was kind of tasked with kind of making the official announcement, and so of course, you know, it's great, you know, hearing from people with the well wishes and all that, but it gets a lot very fast, right? And and so Mike texted and was just like, you know, he was probably the second person that I heard from after I heard Scott died, and the word had already gotten to him. He's like, I just heard something that can't possibly be true. You know, he called and we talked, and he's like, I'm here for you if you need anything or whatever. And I, you know, and he reiterated that, you know, later that afternoon, and he's like, I can definitely meet you for dinner. I'm like, I just need to disconnect from the world, right? I need to disconnect from the phone, put the phone down, quit, you know, doom scrolling, quit. Like, you know, again, the well wishes are a big thing that helped me get through that day, but it's still a lot of emotional, you know, baggage, you know, right? So, and so he kept his word. We went and picked him up and took him to Chewy's, which is the restaurant that Scott and I, I asked Scott to be my host for the show in, and anyway, just happened to kind of work out that way. And we sat there and we talked about Scott and cried over Scott and talked about things, you know, going on in Mike's life, talked about anything that wasn't Scott, you know. But the point is he was, you know, he was there, you know, at that point, you know, when you know, I think a lot of people might have been either afraid they were intruding or not wanting to kind of wade into that very fresh pain, right? Yeah. So yeah, good guy Mike Flanagan. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then that's when was that when he got the idea to dedicate it to Scott, or did he just tell us about?
I think it was that day, yeah, because he told us when we got to the restaurant. He said that he just got a text from his producer saying whatever you need, in terms of like he's like, we're going to dedicate the movie to Scott. So he asked who he was going to ask, and so we knew the day that Scott died that Mike said, I'm going to dedicate the movie to him, and when you see the movie. It's a, you know, it's a hell of a movie to have a dedication on, right? I mean, it's
such a beautiful film.
It's, you know, it's a movie that's all about the importance one person can have, and, you know, with people that they know, people that they don't know, you know, maybe it's all made up people, maybe it's not, you know, it's like, you know, it's a pretty, you know, good going for Scott. You know, if you're going to be an asshole and peace out early, then, you know, get taken down in the prime of his youth, and then, you know, at least, you know, he had the good sense to have it tied to, you know, to this incredible movie, which I think is going to give him a little bit of immortality, you know.
It just fit like almost a little bit too well, like it fits
yeah
it
fits Mike
really well.
Mike, when I interviewed Mike for The Life of Chuck for the KingCast, that happened to be on the exact 1 year anniversary of Scott's death.
Whoa.
Exactly May 31st, 1 year, you know, to the day, where I was sitting down talking with him, and Mike was saying that he's like, yeah, given the themes of the movie, the dedication, the fact that we're sitting around here talking about it exactly a year after, he's like, we were talking about how it all kind of lines up, and he was saying in a way that challenges his hard fought atheism, you know, looking at how kind of neat, you know, that circle, you know, connected to itself, you know.
That's crazy too. It's like that, like Invisible String by Taylor Swift, is just, you know, the connections between all of us and Scott for a lot of people, you know, he affected a lot of people that he never met. And I only talked with Scott a few times and it, you know, he had a pretty big effect on me just in terms of like when I met you guys in Bangor, when I talked to you guys for the KingCast, just very welcoming, very inclusive to everyone. And I think that's, you know, it really truly is the perfect movie to dedicate to him because, yeah, he was an asshole, but he was like the best kind of asshole you can possibly be. He'd be in your corner.
Yeah, one of the things that I'd like to describe Scott is he was a bully for bullies. So,
yes. You know, that's
he was
perfect.
A guy that, like, he was a pit bull against the people who were being the shittiest kind of people to the, you know, and was always there in defense of the downtrodden, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, Scott had a very abrasive, like, front taste to him. I don't know, like, forward taste, the primary taste of Scott, is he was kind of a grumpy asshole and a smart ass. But, like, every story that you hear from anybody that knew him, like, he had, you know, a giant heart too. And he would, like, you know, he would have to do is let his defenses down just a little bit. But, like, I keep hearing stories. I hear new stories about Scott, you know, every couple of weeks. It sounds like somebody, you know, a listener will go, oh, by the way, look at this email chain that I had with Scott when he talked me off the ledge and, you know, at 3 a.m, you know, and he's like, he didn't know me from anybody. And yet he gave me time and it really helped, you know. I you know, just knowing him though, I don't think he was quite aware of the impact he had on people, which, you know, again, makes it a perfect, you know, thing that he is so now tied with the life of Chuck, because it's very much the same thing there. You know, this guy, average business guy, you know, had a, you know, has a lot of really crazy stuff going on in his life, but it's, you know, it's a pretty average life, right? You know, he's got a wife and a kid and just does the 9-to-5, and he's not, you know, selling out stadiums or any of this stuff. He's just a guy going about his life, but you know, but he had zero idea, you know, kind of the impact that that his passing would eventually have, you know.
I think that's there's so many films that are about, like, people wanting to leave this legacy and going out of their way, like Banshees of Inisherin is the first thing that comes to mind. But then you have this, like, you can just exist and be normal and still have this huge impact, and that's what Scott definitely did. He affected us all, and then he got the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
I think this movie is just so beautiful because it talks about just, you don't have to make a huge impact on the world to make a huge impact on the people around you. And it reminds me a lot of even just like It's a Wonderful Life. Like, you just get those kind of undertones of, just because you feel like you haven't done what you wanted to do doesn't mean that you haven't made a huge impact in the world.
Yeah. It's not, again, it's not the easiest flavor to capture for today. You know, I think we live in a very cynical, edgelordy, troll culture centric time, right? So that's why I don't know, the movie could make $5. I have no idea if the appetite's there for it, you know, but those that see it are being moved in profound ways by it.
Yeah.
And you know, I have no idea what the tracking is. For all I know, it's going to be the biggest movie this weekend. I have zero idea, but it's
I'm going to go see it 5 more times. So hopefully that makes a little bit of a difference.
But you're always going to miss that first 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah, on purpose. Now I'm just avoiding it.
No, give us the Italian accent cut. Or
or else I'm not watching.
Riley refuses to watch the full movie.
It'll come out on Blu-ray, and that'll be one of the special features.
Oh, God. I love physical media.
Speaking of the monologue, I think one of the things in the adaptation of the novella to the movie were specifically the monologues that Mike put into them.
Oh my God, this is the movie of monologues. People thought Midnight Mass was the most he could do, and he said, I'm going to compact that shit. Everyone gets a monologue. I loved it.
Hey, y'all, what do you think of Carl Sagan? Let's sit here for 5 minutes and talk about Carl Sagan.
Oh my God. I was so excited because I got Julia, my girlfriend, Cosmos for Christmas, maybe. And she's out of town, so she didn't get to go see the movie with me. And I was so bummed. But now I just get to go see it again.
Yeah.
Are you talking about the scene with when they're on the phone with the calendar? So we've seen it, what, like 3 times now? 4 times?
Three times.
Three times. So the second time, I guess, the first time we saw it in like on the big screen, like I was looking at the stuff written, because he's a teacher, so I was looking at the stuff written on his calendar, and it was like teacher work day or something, or like summer break, and I was like, no, nobody would have that long of a summer, like that's not realistic. And then, but it's, I was so probably funny, the only person ever to have that reaction. And then the other teacher scene where with Chuck's sixth grade class, when Kate is playing the teacher, like every time that I see that scene, I instinctively want to be like, 1, 2, 3, all eyes on me, 1, 2, eyes on you, or like some attention, hocus pocus, everybody focus, because I'm like, that girl needs attention getters, like this, no, do not talk when the kids are talking, make them wait.
That classroom scene was crazy.
Oh, it was so chaotic.
It or is. Get the paddle with the holes drilled into it.
You know what? Because it had to have been the 90s, right? You could still hit kids. No, sorry. I'm going to get canceled.
Well, you can get away with hitting kids easier in the 90s.
Let's yeah, they don't have their phones. They can't document it as easy.
Yeah, the paper airplane throwing and like the noise and stuff, like, yeah, that is very realistic for middle school, but I was like, no, don't try to read when they're making noise. Like, you need to, like, when I taught middle school and they were making noise, it's like you start talking and then pull the and then it throws them off, and they're like, what's she trying to say? And then they start listening, and then you talk. So every time I see that scene, I'm like, girl. But I like how the narration that's going on, the narrator's like a hippy dippy teacher who would not last long in the public school system. I'm like, yeah, because she needs attention getters.
Well, and that scene happened, and I did immediately think of you, because I was like, oh god, I bet this is like the classrooms that you have told me about, but like so much worse.
Yeah, what did you guys? How did you guys feel about Nick Offerman's choice narration? I really liked it.
I think it was perfect.
He was perfect.
Yeah, no, he had so much humor, I think, to it that the movie desperately needs, like right when it's transitioning in that from the our first act, the third act of the story, to the second act. You know, that's especially when Annalise Basso, like when her character and you know, just like, yeah, fuck or whatever, and he's just like, yes, that
sucks. Fuck. Yeah, was incredible. Yeah.
I think that I love Offerman doing it, and also on a Stephen King level, you know, and this is something I think Mike and I talk about on his Kingcast episode about this, where he was saying, we were talking about Offerman kind of having that blue collar feel, right? This is a guy that, you know, makes things by hand, right? He might be a Hollywood actor, you know, but he gives blue collar, as the kids might say, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of Stephen King's bread and butter. And considering that he's essentially the voice of Stephen King in these, in the narration, because that's, you know, most of this is direct from the novella, and most of it is the stuff that Stephen King, the author, is telling you about, right? So much so that Mike even said that there was not an inconsiderable amount of time that he considered asking King to do the narration. But I guess it was like a thing where he said, when Offerman, you know, says yes, they kind of threw a Hail Mary to him and say yes, then it's like, well, then all other ideas go out the window at that point. So, yeah.
But it's very much the, like, people talk about, like, in Stephen King books, there's always, like, the guy wearing the blue chambray shirt because that's, like, the working man, and that's, like, the feel that you get from that narration.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah. Something Life of Chuck does, which I think is really beautiful, is especially in the third act, which is the first thing you see, is the focus on these like blue collar caregivers. I also really liked that our two characters who are estranged, they're ex-spouses. I liked that they didn't have kids, and that wasn't just an automatic thing that bonded them together. I thought it was really beautiful.
Yeah, no, I think it's pretty wonderful to see that there's obviously caring there. And whatever happened. Maybe it has to do with alcohol. The one thing that you hear her say is like, don't do the hard stuff. You know, and you know how you get when you do the hard stuff. And then, of course, he drinks the hard stuff because the world's ending. Come on. When else are you going to drink the hard stuff?
Is that I don't remember. Is that in the story or is that something Mike added? Because that would be very Flanagan-esque.
I don't think
it's in the story. I read the story a couple days before I saw the movie, and I don't remember that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's possible that there, like, there might be that offhanded, like, don't drink the hard stuff, but I don't think it was the focus of that point. But to your point, like, I do love that they're not, you know, that they are just a divorce. They're not in the process of a divorce. They've been divorced, right? And yet they're still in contact. Shit's going down. They still have, you know, caring for each other. And then when things are looking their bleakest, you know, his instinct is, I need to get to her. And her, and what's her first thing that she says when he walks up? Oh, thank God.
Oh, thank God.
Oh, thank God.
I don't know why, but that scene where he's walking to the apartment complex or whatever, and runs into Violet McGraw's character, and she's like, well, if your ex is, why are you going to see her? And he just says, well, I still like her. Like, that's just such a mindset that really, like, doesn't happen. Like, if you're an ex at this point, it's like, I've got them blocked on everything and I hate their guts. It's like, clearly you were together for a reason. Yeah. Maybe, you know, we don't all have to be in love, but we all came from the dirt. Might as well try to get along while we're here.
And people always view a failed relationship as a failure, but it's, you know, a relationship failure isn't necessarily a failure. It's just sometimes you grow apart. And I think there's something very adult about staying in contact with somebody who obviously meant a lot to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and finding that person that, you know, no matter what happened, you know, when everything's going to hell, it's like, this could be the last day on earth. And it, you know, they don't know that when he's going to meet, but certainly feeling like it's all coming to a head at a certain point. Right. And I love that. It's not like they don't get, like, they don't start making out. They don't have, like, a big, you know, lustful thing. They hold hands and they watch the stars, you know, slowly start blinking out of existence. Right. And, you know, and then matter of fact, the final thing that he's going to say to her gets cut off. Right. And it's, you know, I don't know. It's very moving. It's very different. I love the way Chiwetel and Karen Gillan play that couple. I feel the history with those guys, given that 85-90% of their time together on the screen is on the phone, where they're not in the same room with each other. You know, I think that's a really tough thing to kind of do, is knowing that they all film that separately. Right. And God knows what kind of crazy accent Chiwetel recorded for her to listen to. She's doing her bit of it, you know. So, you know, it's pretty remarkable. And then that, it's also, to me, the trickiest part of the movie, right? Because I feel like if the whole thing was the Tom Hiddleston, you know, section acts 2 and 1. But if that was the entire story, where it started with Hiddleston and it stayed just with Chuck, I think that's the more commercial version of this. But there's so much depth to it, and so much of the payoff of, you know, I'm assuming we can talk some spoilers at this point with the thing being out. There's so much payoff to the fact where, you know, you're introduced to these people, and then you start seeing where they popped up in his life, where he filed them in the back of his mind somewhere. He walks past the teacher. You know, they could have had Kate playing that role, right? But I love the fact that Kate isn't the one we see in the first act of the movie.
It's like the
we
background see, people.
Yeah, you see the guy that was running the classroom next to him, just because maybe in the back of Chuck's mind, when he thinks teacher, you know, that's just filed back there. And that person, that inner life that he has within the universe that is Chuck, you know, is there, right? You see the roller skating girl, and, you know, I don't know how easy it is to spot, but Rahul Kohli is in that shot too. Mm-hmm. He's sitting at a table, drinking coffee, but he's wearing, like, nurse's scrubs, you know? So it's like, it's just something. So in my own head canon, Chuck hears us three talking while he's sitting there drinking his coffee. Because that's our physical cameos. We're, like, talking right before he does the big dance, where he's, like, sitting all by himself drinking his coffee, and we're kind of in the background.
Like, Wampler, like, said something funny, and then we're laughing. Yeah. Is what's going on.
So in my mind, he overheard those voices. World. Yeah, he overheard those voices, and that's why we're the NPR hosts. That I'm going to go ahead and say that that's exactly it. And when the movie wins all the Oscars, Mike better thank his muse, which is me.
Yes, obviously.
Obviously.
No, that it's really interesting, though, because I've been reading some of the reviews, and I've been getting frustrated with them, as Kels and Cecilia know, if you look at our group chat. And there are so many people, for whatever reason, that aren't connecting those dots.
Hmm.
And it's just so frustrating. But it reminded me, I don't know if you guys have seen this movie, but Richard Linklater made a movie, I think in the 90s, early 2000s, called Waking Life.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that is very similar and has the same, like, themes of, like, the solipsism kind of philosophy and, like, your neurons firing off while you're dying and that DMT dream of... And it is. It's you contain multitudes. You are everyone you know and everything you've seen and heard. And it's just the lack of media literacy and some of the people leaving reviews is frustrating to no end because there's so much beauty and they just... almost don't want to see it.
It sucks. I the media literacy is in one of my big pet peeves, because listen, like, people hated critics when I was growing up, right? Because but they hated the film critics not because they didn't understand what they saw, but because they maybe were dismissive of blockbuster cinema, or they didn't like horror or whatever, and the stuff I liked. But I almost never ran into a critic that just blatantly didn't understand what they were watching, right?
Well, and that happens and that so is often from now.
Well, there... Oh, now. Okay, because I was going to say, because there was that critic when Fall of the House of Usher came out and was like, had all these like critiques, and it was like, he's clearly never read Poe. And that was...
Oh, I remember this because you were fired up.
Yeah, that was around the time that we went to set, because I remember Mike and I both were like, fired up about it, and we were like, well, he hasn't read Poe. If he says this, that doesn't make sense, and it tells you he's never read this.
I think people are very afraid to admit they don't know something, and so I think sometimes when people say they didn't like it because of this or that, I think sometimes in the back of their brain they're like, I know it's probably either not made for me, or there's something I'm missing, but instead of just saying that, I'm going to pretend like my opinion is fact, because we're so fact-based now. Mm. We can't just take time and digest anything. It's got to be right away, right now.
Yep.
Well, that's like the Disney movie Turning Red, which it's a cute cartoon. It's not intended to be deep, but like, a lot of men were like, I don't like this movie because it's about preteen girls. And they're like, this is a bad movie. And it's like, it's just not made for you.
The critique that I saw of Turning Red that made me turn red was, this movie set in 2001. Why aren't they talking about 9/11? Like, because they're teenage girls in Canada.
Yeah, they're in Canada.
Why didn't Chuck talk about 9/11?
Why isn't Chuck talking about 9/11?
Yep, everybody's got to have an opinion, and nobody can ever back down on what their initial reaction to something was.
There is so much freedom in just saying, oh, I don't know.
Yep.
I
don't know, but I really appreciate it from this movie. Math.
What a
beautiful monologue about math. And I hate math. Don't hate math. Just not good at it.
I have a learning disability that literally means that, like, numbers don't register in my head. It's called dyscalculia, I think.
Yes.
So that all meant nothing to me. But then he started talking about poetry. Walt Whitman's already my favorite poet. So I was like, wait, this I get. Maybe I like math, because now that I'm thinking about it, dancing is math, blah, blah, blah. You know, go listen to the monologue. It's the podcast and the one in the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was beautiful.
Yeah. And ultimately, it's a very realistic message at the heart of it. It's like people love dancers, you know, Chuck,
right,
but they need accountants, right? It's like, so essentially, it's you know, it's don't view what you're, you know, if you end up having to be an accountant or a banker or whatever as a step down, this is something that, you know, that's true for most people. They can't make a living doing their passion. And that's just, you know, because of supply and demand, really. So, but, you know, people need accountants. That's,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's nice to find the passion within the thing that you are kind of, you know, maybe don't want to do. Right. And I think that, you know, that kind of gives you this little zest for life, maybe. That's all we need is just one little spark of passion to keep us going.
Right.
And I think that speaks to, especially American society, we're so centered around what we do for a living. Like, there's not a lot of other places in the world. The first question you ask someone is, what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Like, I do a lot of stuff. I took a shit earlier. What do you do?
So work doesn't define you, but in American society.
Was it a hard shit? Was it,
was it a difficult one
or was it?
I'll send you a picture later.
Okay.
But I mean, like, to put it in kind of more current day terms, like
poop talk.
Ouch.
What?
No, I'm fucking with you.
When you ask like elementary school kids what they want to be when they grow up, which is something that I have a lot of experience doing, they will say influencer or something like that, which I know, like, my generation would be like professional athlete or like actor. Mm. So it's really not that far off. It's just their generation's version. But it's like, we don't need like 200,000 influencers or YouTubers. We need some teachers. We need some doctors. Like, we need some accountants. We need some sanitation workers. Mm. Like, there's all these things that we need. And, you know, they're all just as important. They're not flashy like the influencer or YouTuber.
Right.
But, like, we need them. Like, that scene when I forget the character's name. The teacher from the beginning.
Oh, Chiwetel's character.
Yeah, his character. I don't remember his character's name.
Does he have a name?
He does.
Yeah. He's sitting on the car. And he's talking to Matthew Lillard's character. Yeah. And then they stop and they talk to that lady who works at the bank. Like, it's all these, like, professions, I guess, that you might say are, like, looked down upon. But they're, like, important in that scene.
Yeah, that's who he's focusing on. Yeah. He's focusing on teachers, you know, accountants, doctors, bankers, you know, or nurses.
They're construction workers.
Construction workers. Yeah, it is. It's really, even with the... Riley doesn't know this part because it's the very opening of the movie, but, like, it's the, you know, the parade of parents that are coming in, you know, it's not, you know, what their concerns are, you know, they're all like, you know, whether it's
Pornhub
being down or, you know, the
okay. I did read about that on Letterboxd. That was in someone's review.
Yep.
That always gets the biggest laugh. Like, every time that we see it, like, no matter where it is, it gets
what a, it's funny, but it's also kind of like the quote. I love it. He's like, that's just mean.
Yeah. Well, I love how the teacher plays it too, because so much of that is like the teacher going, okay, well, I know things are going crazy. I don't know when the internet's coming back. He's like, but we got to focus on your kid. And I love it, that moment where he's just like, did you know that Pornhub's down? And he just goes, yeah, I noticed. He's like, we can mourn Pornhub together. Yeah.
Honestly, though, that's when you know. That's like the start of some Handmaid's Tale shit, is when they scrub all the porn from the internet.
No. Hey, Texas has banned Pornhub. I think Florida has.
Wait, really?
Whoa. Yeah.
I think Utah has, too.
Yeah. Yikes. A lot of these conservative states are, well, they're not banning it so much as they're essentially going, you need to do an age verification thing, which then means nobody's ever gonna, you know, people want to look at free porn, they're not gonna be putting in their personal information, right?
They're just spending money on VPNs now.
Yeah. So it's Texas is one of those where they got rid of Pornhub essentially by threatening this law, and Pornhub just, you know, doesn't go to Texas anymore. So just what you needed to know and learn while tuning into this episode of The Monologue.
Yeah, that's what we're here for. Pornhub updates.
It's all Mike's fault, really, so.
It's all he talks about, honestly. He's just spreading the word. Speaking of insanely beautiful monologues, though, that is about where I, because I was stuck in traffic before I got to the movie, walked in, and it was seconds before Matthew Lillard is walking up to the yard to talk about what's going on.
Yeah.
And, oh no, was it relevant to today.
God, it's so beautifully acted too.
Yeah, Matthew Lillard is, I am very glad we're having this little resurgence and he's popping up quite a lot more and more in horror stuff than this. He's
Lillard
is
Palooza?
He in Carrie? I think
There's
didn't they just announce?
Yeah, he was officially announced.
Yeah,
for
as the principal, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Hey.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and he's coming back, and he'll be in the next Scream as well. So yeah.
But he's known. For
I still well. Oh, yeah, his best role that I've ever seen. The most perfectly cast thing.
Oh my gosh, love
well,
Scream.
I got to tell him this story in person, but when we went to a press screening of Five Nights at Freddy's, they had a trivia contest to win prizes, and so they're asking questions about the people in the movie, and one of them is like, what franchise is Matthew Lillard known for? And I very confidently said, Scooby-Doo! And they're like, no, Scream.
No,
and we're telling the story, and he's like, "I'm Scooby-Doo."
Yeah, they're both accurate.
He's like, to our generation, he is Shaggy.
Mm-hmm.
If you say, imagine
that's what I said.
What's his last Shaggy Rogers
Bottoms?
Shaggy Bottoms. Does he?
I don't know.
With
I don't
know. That but dog. That made me happy, though, that Matthew Lillard was not offended that I know him from Scooby-Doo.
No, he seems like he'd probably be genuinely happy because obviously they had a blast making that. You can tell. But yeah, I'm glad it was just very perfectly cast. It's nice to see some new faces. Also nice to see a lot of familiar faces. Speaking of, I cannot remember the actress's name who does play the banker, but she's in The Haunting of Hill House as well. I think she's the first person you see on screen.
The same lady.
The one that almost hits him with her shoes when he walks up.
Is that the same one who has the house and the husband that she.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even catch that.
We talked to her at the after party at the premiere.
And tell them who you ended up sitting next to. So it was like me, Kelsey, and.
I was sitting next to Michael Trucco.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I missed Trucco, too. I missed him. I missed Surian, I think, from Follow the House of Usher.
The student reading the poem. Of the,
yeah, oh, yeah, I missed him. I missed Harvey Guillen. So I definitely missed a lot in the first 10 minutes of this movie.
There are so many cameos. I mean, there's Hamish, Linklater, Carlo Gugino. She's got a voice part. There's
I introduced her to the, because I say, and now we'll be back after this break or whatever. And then she comes in and she does the, thanks, Chuck, for 39 great years. Yeah.
Oh, I have
Miss Carla.
A cameo that might not be caught as often. It is in the credits, though. Axel Carolyn does the French announcer.
I saw that. Shout out to Axel. We've got to talk to her at some point. She makes incredible films. And one of the best episodes of The Haunting of Bly Manor. But yeah, that was very cool. And then there's some, my most anticipated cameo always in anything Mike does is, I guess Pope Incognito is Jewish now. he's gone deep in
Rabbi Incognito.
Rabbi Incognito. Rabbi Incognito.
Oh, no. But that's, I'm always looking out and in my head I'm like, wow. Mike is keeping our personal inside joke alive. I'm a little delusional, but.
Another Easter egg. I just said, was the Lasser Glass in The Life of Chuck anywhere? I didn't
catch it.
Because Trevor sure Macy is in it as well as one of the mourners. But that was the only other. I wasn't looking for much background stuff. I don't know. We'll have to.
It's got to be in the grandparents' house, I think, because that would be the only place where it would fit.
Oh, that would make sense.
Yeah.
That should have been the only thing that was in the cupola.
That's where all the ghosts were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to do a little
Easter egg. Yeah, I'll have to keep an eye out for it. I was looking to see if anyone had posted anything about it on Reddit, but
no. Eric took a selfie with the cupola.
Yeah, so we were there for 3 days on set. Two of them were Tom Hiddleston dancing, which wasn't the full days for each of those days. So like, we also saw him do the scene where he was with the buskers at the fountain and they were like passing out the money. We watched him do the dusk scene where he's walking Annalise Basso, like, back out and like in front of the neon and all that stuff. And he sees Violet McGraw
skating up and all that. At the table. See, was the first time that I had been on a film set ever. So I was terrified. So my phone was like off and in my purse the whole time.
For the best.
I didn't take any pictures, but Eric did, and then just like hid them on his camera until it came out.
Well,
so.
You know.
Yeah.
Unlike some people.
Oh, nice.
No, that is, that's awesome.
Did you see any ghosts? Did you see any future tellings?
But knowing what the, I mean, this was just like a little stage.
Okay, so it wasn't like a practical house. It was a set.
So the third day was us, like, here's us, like,
with the neon,
as they're all, I don't know, it's all blurry.
It's hard to see.
You know, but the third day was, they went to, like, essentially to the little building where they house their production office, and they shot all, like, the end of life stuff with Hiddleston. So him in bed, the scene where he's, like, he has that monologue where they're talking about where the origin of the scar is, and it's him and his wife in bed, and he's, like, saying that I told her the true story.
And she's, like, putting the ice pack and stuff. Yeah.
So it was all that stuff, and then the cupola was built up there, too. So that's where I'm like, ooh, I know what that is, and I mean, like... I walked up, the hallway was decked, but it was funny. Once you like turn the corner, all you see is the plywood. It's all just the plywood in the corner of like a warehouse room. So
not as spooky.
Yeah.
But absolutely beautiful last shot of that film, though. I kept wondering how it was going to wrap up. And I think just sitting in there with that ghost. Mm-hmm. I sat through until the lights came up because it hit me really hard, that end of that movie.
Yeah.
And because you were looking for his name in the
credits. And because I waited and I was like, all right, who did I miss? Oh, there Eric goes. All right.
Yeah, no, it's funny because, again, I'm not an actor, but in order for me to have the voice cameo, like I had to go through and fill out all the paperwork and essentially get the exemption from the Screen Actors Guild as an indie film or whatever to be an independent contractor. But the thing is that gives me points to where if I have one more role like that, then I can be Screen Actors Guild eligible.
You can get your card.
You get my SAG card. But again, like I think that's like a $10,000 you know, thing you have to put down.
So you'd have to book a bigger job than that.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So, you know, if Mike needs some more radio announcers or the DJ announcing the stuff at the prom at Carrie.
Oh, speaking of DJ, did you guys catch that Alon is the DJ?
You can see his hair even when he's out of focus. I was like, oh, there's Alon and Molly as Chuck's mom.
Chuck's mom, yeah. Right.
I love that the dance is Back to the Future themed. I didn't catch that until like the second time that we saw it. And I was like,
oh, that's why he's dressed like Doc Brown. I wonder why he was in like a lab coat.
And then the boyfriend of Chuck's dance partner was dressed like Marty McFly. And at first I was like, oh, is that just like the trend of the era that they're portraying? And then I'm like, oh, no, he's dressed like Marty.
Yeah, I couldn't tell because I think in that scene, Chuck just has like his little suit on.
Yeah, he's not
on theme.
Yeah.
He dances to the beat of his own drum, or to those Buskers drums, I guess. The beat of his own drum.
So I guess there is a good question that's kind of posed at the end of this movie. The end of the story is we realize that Chuck has foreknowledge of his own death. Now it's hard to pinpoint, you know, because we saw that makeup in person. It was really kind of upsetting seeing Hiddleston in that makeup. It was
scary.
It wasn't like, you know, sometimes you can see a movie monster, it needs the right lighting or whatever, but it really looked like Hiddleston like was deeply sick when recording that. And so the age is a little indiscriminate. Like you can't really tell. You know, they're dying super young in that that thing. But the point is he's still now knowing what the cupola, and I'd said cupola for my entire life until this movie, so I don't know what's true. But now I'm saying cupola just because now I feel like I'll be totally wrong if it's established in the movie. So.
I feel like if you were to use all the vowels and stuff the way that we teach little kids to sound out their words, it should be it should be cupola. Because but they say cupola.
They
so
say
I
cupola
don't know.
All the time.
Francis Ford Coppola is dumb.
I don't know.
But, you know, they've established at this point, you know, what the ghosts in the cupola are, and that's essentially you can see your death, you can see the death of people you know around you. You get just an image of what that could be, and so he knows, you know, as the Jacob Tremblay version, the 17-year-old version of Chuck, knows that's him and that he's going to die. And kind of the last narration is him, like, talking about, you know, I guess not narration. He articulates it. Tremblay says the narration out loud, essentially, saying, you know, it's like, oh, I'm just going to take this and I'm going to bury it and just live my life as if I didn't know this. What would you guys do if you saw your own? Here's the podcaster in me coming in. Like, what would you get if you foresaw and you knew the exact, maybe not exactly how it comes about, but you knew the basic circumstances? Mm-hmm. Is that something that would drive you crazy, or would you just like just try to mind wipe it out so you can not go insane?
I wouldn't want to look at all. Like, if I, like, I would be like the grandpa and have the lock on the door so that I'm not even tempted to mm-hmm. look. I wouldn't want to know.
Yeah.
Cecilia, I want you to answer.
I think I would look.
Yeah.
But I don't think I'd be tormented by it. I think there's something really beautiful about it because people are so afraid of it. Mm-hmm. But in the end, we all know it's going to end. It's just something about us as people. We just don't like to accept it because we don't know what's going to happen after death. But I think there is something really beautiful about life, and like the Carl Sagan monologue goes, is we're here for such a short mm-hmm. amount of time that you really just have to look at the people around you and hold them close, because you never know what's going to happen. You never walk outside, you get hit by a bus, mm-hmm. you get a terminal illness, or you live a really long life. You just never know.
Yeah. You can drop dead of a heart attack, you know, and like, you know, the man who's
like who some been
dedicated to, it's like, you know, it's,
yeah,
you know, it's, you just never can tell. It's like, I don't know if I'd want to know, but like, I think that having the knowledge of it, that's where the question's interesting to me, is like, what do you do then? You know, like if you see it and you see it and you know that it's you and you know it's true, you know, like, I guess it also depends if you see it when you're 17 and you're like, that's a completely different person from you in that bed. But, you know, like Mark Hamill's character, you know, when the grandfather sees it and he grabs his arm and he sees somebody looking very goddamn familiar to him, right? This isn't decades off. This is years off, maybe, right? If you're lucky. And, you know, I don't know, like maybe that I would turn into that guy and I would turn to drinking to try to drown that out. I don't know. But I could see that being something that would weigh heavily especially if I saw, like, wait a minute, I recognize that isn't an old man in that bed. Mm-hmm. Right. It's like if I saw that would have a you know, that would definitely play, you know, a number on my psyche.
Oh,
what about you, Riley?
I think, okay, so the scene where Mark Hamill is finally kind of revealing a little bit about what the ghosts are, or that there are ghosts, he says something along the lines of, like, waiting is the worst part. So I feel like I don't need to see it, because we already know. I don't know. I think it would definitely bring more acceptance, but I also think that's kind of the what I took away from it mostly, was like, waiting is the worst part. Why am I just, I feel like I'm perpetually waiting for my life to end instead of actually living. No. So I don't know. I am very afraid of death. I have thanatophobia or whatever, thanophobia, whatever. Watching Mike's stuff and the way that he talks about and handles death has made me accept it a lot more and be a lot less scared. So I don't know.
I think that, you know, maybe Chuck has the right idea, because I think that Chuck internalizes it in the way that you just did, where he remembers the waiting is the hardest part. And what he said essentially says to himself, I'm going to live my life to the fullest, and I'm not going to be sitting here counting the days for until I'm in that bed. Right.
Yeah.
So that's my much worse paraphrasing of the great Stephen King and then the great Mike Flanagan's words on top of it. But I mean, that's kind of how you have to do it. I guess the question then, I become a little bit of a problem solver in these kind of situations. And so then I would be like,
I love to be prepared. Wait a minute,
does it make me immortal? Like if I see it and I'm like 90 in that bed, it's like,
if I never wear the clothes that I see my dead self wear, does that mean I live forever?
Is this locked in stone? Can I, like, if I jumped off of a skyscraper, what would happen? You know? And then, you know, it's like, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, clearly I'm, you know, I'm able-bodied and whatever happens when I'm, you know, 90, you know, that's where it gets dangerous for me. It's just like, am I bulletproof now? Because death can't come for me. Now I've seen how it ends.
I wouldn't want to look because I would be like the grandma in the new Final Destination movie that like compiles all the research of all these possible ways that you could die. Like that'd be me. Like I would no.
No.
Well, to be fair, she does come to accept it at some point, or at least kind of just dies to prove a point.
Yes.
I think my thing is I don't mind seeing my own death, but I don't want to see the death of people I know.
When
that's where I'm like...
Oh, when his wife died and when you realized that he had seen that, I immediately was like, God, I hope I die before my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Oh...
Who's dying first?
No.
Are you gonna fill heart?
You guys can just notebook it, go out together.
Oh my god, what a good idea.
Or no. Titanic, depends what kind of sadness you want.
Well, they absolutely don't go out together. Yeah, Titanic. No,
the old couple on the bed.
Oh, okay.
Wow, that's like an 80-year difference.
It's like,
just drown him, I guess. Who cares?
Then Rose goes on, said, "Not, don't get on my door. No, no, you can't sit
there.
Can't fit you on my door."
I mean, to be fair, it would have sank. But
well, on the top of Titanic, I think that's a good place to start to wrap up.
To kind of start sinking this ship. Yeah, I have a thought. You know that scene where suddenly Kate Siegel is there, and she has got Chuck by here and is looking deeply in his eyes.
And calls him an idiot sandwich.
What are you?
What are you? I'm an idiot sandwich.
When I met Kate Siegel, she and I also, for a brief moment, looked deeply into each other's eyes for a completely normal reason. And it did fix me. So honestly, highly suggest seeing this movie. I feel like, you know, that'll fix you. It'll fix you right up, guys.
Just look into Kate Siegel's eyes and you're cured.
Like, just for a couple minutes. She's got such a calming presence. So I would recommend the movie just for that.
Calming?
She's a mom. The
same person. She is delightfully chaotic, but chaotic nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. There's calm in the chaos.
Yeah. Oh, I have ADHD. That's like how my brain operates.
So Eric, do you have anything that you would like to plug? Where can our listeners find you?
Yes.
What would you?
No. Well, I mean, I'm at home with Kelsey a lot, but
would you like to give your address
here?
Oh yeah. Shout out. We'll have them send you fan mail.
Yes. Yes. Send us fan mail that is signed checks. We have a wedding and a honeymoon.
You can always hand deliver them. They don't mind.
Yes. Yeah. Sure. Why not? No, but, you can find both the KingCast and the Spiel wherever you get your podcasts. Particularly if you're really curious about the life of Chuck, we had a pretty crazy run. The last, I don't know, four guests have been Life of Chuck. So we had Matthew Lillard, Mike Flanagan, Karen Gillan, and Tom Hiddleston.
So it's four guests, but three episodes, because there's a Matthew Lillard episode, a Mike Flanagan episode, and then Tom Hiddleston and Karen Gillan are in one episode.
Yeah, Karen we got for like 25 minutes, and Tom we got for like, supposed to be 30, we got almost 40 with them, so that's about the length of one of our episodes, so we just smooshed them together. All those are really great chats, and everybody was wonderful there, and they get a little sad. We talk a lot about the Wampler of it all. You know, Mike kind of goes deep into the dedication process and you know, what it means to him to have the movie dedicated to Scott and why it's important and all that stuff. So you'll laugh, you'll cry, and then you'll hear some outrageous Italian accents. So find us. Yeah, we're available wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, wherever. So,
all right. Thank you, Eric, so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for letting me jump in with the fiancé here and hone in on her territory.
Anytime that she lets you off that leash, we'll let you on the show.
Yeah, now I have to go back in my closet? Can I at least have dinner first or no?
What leash?
What leash? Oh, in the closet, I see. Interesting.
Which leash?
What Moida? Oh,
no. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll catch you next week.
Bye.